Michael Whelan here in Talla. Michael, tell me a little bit about your background first, because I know that you had an interesting army career, but we'll start at the beginning.
I started off with my birth. My name is Michael Whelan. I'm living in Talla for the last 30 odd years. I come from a military background. My father and my grandparents were all military men, as are my brothers. When I was younger, my father was a soldier. I lived in all the married quarters in Dublin, which is Cahalbrua Barracks, Griffith Barracks, and Clancy Barracks. So military background, even when as I sometimes say, I'm a soldier since I was born. Strict military background, childhood. I joined the Air Corps in 1990, so I've 18 years service now. I'm an airman, and I run the Air Corps Military Museum and Heritage Project in Ballydonnell. And I have a master's degree in history, so I do a bit of history myself. I have two overseas missions, South Lebanon and Kosovo. So that's what peacekeeping and peace enforcement missions there. So I have a bit of experience with the peacekeeping end of things.
All right, yeah, but tell me now, what's your father's name?
Same as my own, Michael Whelan.
Michael. And what was Michael doing? Where was he? You were telling me he was in all the different barracks.
Well, he was based in Clancy Barracks in Island Bridge, but he had married quarters, which at the time you could be moving. As your family got bigger, you would move to a bigger house, even though you were all very small. So as our family got bigger, we moved around. So even though he was based in one barracks, we lived in married quarters for other barracks.
Yeah. What about your granddad? Any military?
Both my grandfathers were in the army during the emergency. My mother's side was in the artillery, and my grandfather on my father's side was on the signal corps. And the artillery regiment was in McKee Barracks, where my brother serves now. And my father's father, the signal corps, was in Collins's Barracks in Dublin, which is now the National Museum. And I served for a long time in the signal corps, so maybe that was a family trait, I'm not sure. Before that, my great-grandfathers were in the Irish Army and the British Army during the First World War, so kind of a long tradition.
Yes, indeed, isn't it? Yeah, it goes way back.
I never made chief of staff, so it doesn't really mean anything.
Always uniforms in the house, though.
Yeah, well, there's always been a military element, you know. There was gaps where there was nobody in the Army through old age and periods until we joined in the 90s, you know, but even when they weren't in the army, we had an army great coat over us in bed as children, so the symbolism was always there, you know, if you know what I mean.
And your grandfather, from your maternal side as well as your father's side, they took part during the troubles in the 1916-1923, did they?
Well, that's my great-grandfathers. Yes. They were in the First World War, and they came in. After independence, the British Army recruited ex-British soldiers, possibly up to 50% of the army. This is a topic I've just finished writing a book on, and he would have been one of them. He went on to be civil servant then, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, what information did you gather, or did you investigate into their background?
They
did, you know.
It's pretty difficult because when I was younger, even though I liked history, I didn't really ask the questions. But now that my grandparents have gone, I feel very bad about that I didn't ask them the proper questions. But just before my grandmother died there 2 years ago, I managed to get some information off her. And I have her brother lives in England at the moment, and he's an ex-Irish soldier who fought in the Battle of Alamein in Britain, in North Africa in the 40s. And I managed to find out some information off him that his father, basically my great-grandfather, he fought in North Africa in the First World War, and he joined the Free State Army in 1923 and became one of the four sergeant majors, and he worked in McKee Barracks, and he left in 1926 or thereabouts and became a civil servant. But during his time in the army, he worked in Dublin Castle, so he was there for the whole transition period, and apparently he suffered from stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, and they call it shell shock then, as you know. And he also suffered from the shakes, you know, malaria and stuff like that. So, but other than that, I'm not too sure about his career. He was a hard man, basically, and he gave the family a hard time in the 20s and 30s. So they didn't really have a lot of good things to say about them sometimes, you know. But that's the people in those days. They had different dynamics of life, didn't they? Different stresses and survival.
So he kind of took it out on his family, whatever.
To a certain extent, yeah. It was hard, man, you know.
Yeah. And how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Well, you have three brothers and one sister.
And any interest in...
in the military? Yeah. I'm the oldest in the, of the siblings, of the children. I'm 38 this year. And my younger brother next to me, he'd be 37, living in England. He was in the army till about 10 years ago. And I have my youngest brother, the baby, he was 26 now. He's in the artillery regiment in McKee Barracks, and he came home from Liberia about 2 years ago after a 6 month stint in Liberia, and he may be going to Chad peacekeeping now in the next year or two. So
all the Whelans, all involved.
All the Whelans. Except for one brother and my sister, yeah.
Yeah. And my goodness, yeah. That's a great record, you know, to have that many involved. So it follows in the family. It came down. When you joined first, what was your first experience and where did you go?
My first experience in the Irish Army, let me say, it's 18 years ago. Actually, it's funny, I was talking about this today. People are bringing up memories to me that they had who I trained with, and I'm trying to remember exactly what happened. You know, that's funny stories. But my first experience with the military was in the reserves, the SCA, in the mid-1980s. And that was only one night a week and maybe every second or third weekend. And I couldn't handle it. It was too strict. And I said I'd never join the army. And then I ended up being in the army full time. Don't know how that happened, but I joined the command training depot in the Depot East in Catbrew Barracks on the 12th of February 1990, command training Depot East. And my first experience was going in there and noticing all the long haircuts and all the terror in the people's faces. And the NCOs were very nice to us and courteous, but as soon as we signed the dotted line and took the oath, they turned into tyrants. So big awakening there, you know. So,
Did you sense all the history in there, in Catbrew Barracks?
I didn't sense it during the training because you didn't have time to think, basically, when you're training as a soldier. Your whole life just gets turned upside down. But before that and afterwards and ever since, I'm a military historian. I know everything about the barracks. But even growing up, Dublin City, just outside Dublin City, I would know all about 1916 and Civil War and all the threads of life that go through the city centre. Like my grandfather, who I told you about, and who was in the artillery, on my mother's side, he was born in January 1916, just off Stephen's Green. So he, in April 1916, the rising occurred. His grandmother would have had to protect him during the 1916 rising. Because if he hadn't, like, you know, children died during the 1916 rising with the shelling. If he hadn't survived, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you right now, you know. So all that means a lot to me. And when I was in Catbrew Barracks training, before and after was basically training, I knew about Sheehy Skeffington being murdered there and buried in the camp, in the barracks for a while. You know, all the atrocities and everything that went on, military.
Michael Collins walking up and down.
Oh, yes, that's where his offices were, yeah. And they're still there. And military archives are there, which I use a lot on my own research. So,
what is it about a young lad starting off going into the army? I mean, was there an attraction for you, or was it just because your father was in there before you?
I don't think it was too much because my father was in there. Maybe my grandparents, who are kind of mystical or mythical to me, like I didn't understand them, but I knew they'd been soldiers. And being into playing with my toy soldiers when I was a child and watching the old movies, you know, there was a sense of belonging there. Maybe it was the mystery of people who served in the army, the camaraderie, I'm not sure. But that's what I was interested in until I joined and I realised that was a lot different. So I wasn't meeting my father. But I think to be a soldier, how would you say this? To be a soldier, it's a different life. It's a different life. It's something different that not many people get to experience, unless there's a massive war on, people are thrown into that environment. But to have the choice to join and be a soldier, it's a big decision, you know. It's a big decision, so you have to think about it for a long time. But when you're in there and you experience it, you've kind of made a bond with people. Like, I've served overseas and I might not see those guys for 20 or 30 years, but once I meet them again anywhere, it could be in the middle of a Connaught Street, straight away I'll know that I stood beside him on a road somewhere, or we risked it all for something, you know. And that's probably the wrong term, but yeah, it's that comradeship, you know.
Yes.
So that
yes.
means a lot to me. And I have a thing in my head, though. I must understand the dynamic of military life. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's something to do with the family history, but I just love the dynamic of the military. I don't particularly think I'm a great soldier. But it's just something in that thread of life that people expose themselves to, if you know what I mean.
Certainly. Is it for the money?
No, it's definitely not for the money. Jesus, was it? Sorry for questioning. It was for the money. I don't think I'd be still in there, you know. But no, it's not the money.
Is it for the discipline?
The discipline is good. Discipline is good. You learn to look after yourself, basically. Look after your family. But it's probably a part of it, yeah. But I don't think it's the whole thing. It's hard to explain. How can people... We've never really fought a major war here. The last time we fought a war was the Civil War, and after that was the 60s round to the Congo, you know. But in that 40-year period, the Irish soldiers were never in a sustained combat environment. The last time they were in a war, basically, the Civil War, the last time they were under fire was in the Civil War. Then they go to the Congo, first time out of the country, sometimes out around town and villages, go to Africa and end up fighting in battles there. Not even many people in Irish society understand that period yet, or still. But to talk to them guys and listen to their stories, as you've probably done yourself, that is a moment in their lives, and it's probably the highlight of their lives, you know.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that gets me, like, you know, that's something that happened 10 years before I was born. But I know more about the Congo than I do about the 21st century.
Tell me about your own experience abroad in the army. Now, I know first you went to Beldonnell, isn't it, and you joined the Air Corps there.
I actually joined in Cattlebrew Barracks, and I was posted to Beldonnell 6 months after that, at the end of my training. Most of the platoon was sent up there, you know.
And what was your brief? What were you...
Just a line soldier, basically. No trade or anything like that. I've since earned a trade in there, but just as a line soldier, infantry soldier.
And what's the trade?
My trade was in aircraft repair, vehicle body repair, spray painting and stuff like that. I'm an aircraft technician, basically.
Yeah, and would you be mechanically minded?
Well, for the period of the trade, the 4 years I was, but as soon as I got out of that, I started another course, which was a degree at nighttime degree in Maynooth to learn about history, research and history. And that took 6 years to attain a master's. So I've moved on from that, but I run a museum out there, and sometimes a lot of that is restoration and getting stuff repaired, you know, aircraft repaired and stuff like that. I've built a dozen aircraft in the museum in various stages of repair.
Do you think the work that you did in those early days in Beldonnell has stood to you now in the preparation for a museum and putting it together? And
definitely. Well, the first 4 years of my career, I was in different jobs, and then I was in the signals section. So I didn't really get my trade until 1997, and that took four years. So in that 4 year period, I would work on aircraft and vehicles of all types, and I learned the trade of restoration and preparation.
Yeah.
That has stood to me I know what has to be done on these aircraft.
Did you know the make of each one of those aircrafts, and you know, and the different tanks and trucks and everything involved in the anything that moves in the military?
Do we know which one is?
Oh, yeah, are you familiar with all of these?
I'm familiar with the aircraft and the Air Corps. I'm familiar with most of the vehicles, what their roles are. Ask me what the role of an aircraft is or an army vehicle, I can tell you. But don't tell me, ask me what the name is. I wouldn't know all the names, but I can tell you what it is because I probably sat in most of them.
Did you?
In the early days anyway. But I have a fair idea of the military apparatus, yeah. But as regards my preparation for the museum, that's a local arrangement. That's not something the army authorities have put in place. I basically put that museum there myself with their cooperation. And it's come so far now that it's kind of hard for them to hide it or put it away, basically. So I have a lot of autonomy in the museum to get stuff done. So I've gathered up to dozen or so aircraft and hundreds of bits and pieces of military aviation artifacts and, how would you say, memorabilia. So it's in there, and as long as it's there, it's safe, if you know what I mean. The preparation in the trade.
Are you familiar with there's another person who has a museum in Cork and runs that. His name is Tom Welsh, is it?
Do you mean in the barracks?
In the barracks there, yeah.
He's a civilian now. I think he's an ex-soldier. But the two people involved in that museum who I'd know would be Brendan O'Shea, who was a lieutenant colonel, and Jerry Whitechalky, who was a quartermaster. I know them pretty well, yeah. So Dan Harvey was there too. The four of them basically set that museum up. So they know a lot about me, and I know a lot about them. We're kind of... Anybody who's into the heritage and trying to keep it alive, we all have kind of got contact with each other, you know.
The medals, do the medals mean much to you? The 1916 medals, the...
I thought you were going to ask about my own medals.
No, all the Irish Army medals, you know, the emergency medals.
Yes.
The,
well, they don't mean a lot to me.
The black and tan medal.
Well, they mean stuff to me. What they mean to me is that's a period of Irish military historiography that hasn't really been told properly, you know, but it marks a person's existence, you know what I mean? The person who earned that medal obviously left his family one morning and went out, risked his life, risked everything he had, and whether he survived or not, hopefully he got the medal, but it marks that period in Irish history, which Irish society doesn't really understand at the moment. And whether you will at any stage, I don't know. But that's what it means to me, that's a person's marker. They existed and they took part in something. Mm-hmm. Am I a medal hunter? No, I don't collect them. I have four of my own, which I wear seldom. What they mean, my medals mean to me is I can hand them to my children and they'll have them when I'm gone. But there is people in the army who collect the medals and keep that history alive. I know what a medal means to a person. If I saw a medal, I could say, I know what that is. A World War, any kind of medal, or most of them, I can give you a bit of a brief history on, you know.
What about Stars and Stripes? I mean, do you think it's important that, you know, the different ranks in the army, money-wise it does, obviously, the higher ranking you are, the more better off you are. But do you strive for success in the army to go up through the ranks?
I don't personally. I've 18 years service and I'm still a low rank of it. I'm an airman, which is equivalent of to a private soldier. So I've 3 years left to go before I can go on a pension after 21 years, and I can't see myself getting promoted in that time. But that's not something I'm after, because if I go after promotion, I'll be pulled away from the things that I love about the army, which is the heritage and the history. But there is people who go after the rank. Not fair play to them, but it's not me. Well, I'm going to answer that one.
Is there politics in the army, in the Irish army?
There's politics in every facet of life, every piece of society of life. And the military in any country is no different. Some people will say there's a kind of a class distinction in the Irish army. And I can say, looking back to 1922, that there is a class, thread of class distinction. Now, that's going to be a hard question to answer. But there is politics. Without sounding like I'm an idiot, how do you answer this question? Politics. Could you just pause that for a second? I can't think of the... Okay, well, class, favoritism and politics in the army. In some respects, it's how long you're in the army. If you're new in the army, you're going to get the crap end of the stick, you know, and you have to work your way through that. If you're a long time in, there is a kind of, how would you say, you won't get the crap jobs more so, but it's getting yourself to that point where you can say that as well, you know. If you're in a clique, you can work things to your own advantage. It shouldn't be like that, and it's not like that in every place, or don't get me wrong, it's not like that in every place or every level. But it does exist. But it exists everywhere, you know. But I think in an army, you should be promoted or get the respect on the merit and what you can provide or as an asset to the system. But a lot of times it doesn't work. And in the Irish army, it's pretty small. And a lot of people are struggling to make their way through that, you know. And sometimes it can be very demoralising.
Is it really? Is it frustrating and annoying that, you know, you're out there every day, you're doing, you know, that you're not moving on, that you're not getting, you're not bettering yourself by getting into better position in the army?
Well, it can be like that. You see, the army has been cut down a lot over the last few years, and everybody should have the right or the the chance to make their passage through the system. So there is a lot of competition for the few vacancies that come up, you know. So, for instance, there's a thing now that you have to have overseas services, you have to have all this kind of criteria to get promoted, then you have to go through the interview. So everybody's got that competition. And maybe that's what it's like everywhere else. But it can be very, very frustrating for a lot of people. And I do see people banging their heads off the wall sometimes, you know. But you have to go with the motion and do what you have to do, you know.
How do you see the Irish Army comparing with other armies around the world?
Well, I've served overseas in South Lebanon and Kosovo on two occasions, and I've seen other armies in motion. The British Army are very professional, but they're way overstretched. The Irish Army is very professional. We're a small defence force, but we are overstretched. Compared to the Belgians, the Swedes, the Norwegians, who will be conscript armies now, not professional. They have a professional officer corps. No, most of them don't have an NCO corps. It kind of bugs me a bit because they are a conscripted army. They're not professional per se as we're supposed to be. And they have all the facilities and all the resources. We're a professional army from a republic. We don't have all the resources. They are providing material now, but it can be very annoying, especially overseas when you see guys going around with the state-of-the-art material and we're trying to catch up. But it's changing slowly, you know.
Yeah.
But you can see another thing about the promotion aspect in the Irish Army can be pretty slow. And you see another army where you've got young fellas who'll be 5 or 6 times higher in rank to you, and you've got more life experience than them, you know. But they have that facility there, and you can't get too frustrated about it, but it happens.
Tell me your experience in the Lebanon. Tell me your experience in the Lebanon when you. What year did you go there?
I went to Lebanon around March or April 1994, so it's 14 years ago this year. It's my first experience overseas.
And who was your commander on that occasion?
I can't actually remember the battalion commander's name. His first name was Donald something, or I can't remember what his second name was.
How many of you?
It was a full battalion, so I think it was close to 600 of us there, with the corps, the support element and the headquarter element down in the quarter, which is beside the Israeli border. So it was a summer trip, and I went out to signal platoon, with no experience of signals, so I had to learn it on the ground out there. My first experience was getting off the airplane in Beirut Airport, and seeing that the whole place was demolished. There was craters in the buildings. There was the tarmac was torn up with gunfire, damage from rockets and that, you know. And the heat was immersive. I got off the opened the door on the plane and I couldn't breathe, and I was halfway down the airplane. Going to the hills was about a 3 to 4 hour drive from the airport up to the hills where the AO was, the area of operations. That was a kind of a unique experience, seeing all the villages. It was like looking back into medieval times. I could imagine the Crusaders now. That sounds funny. I don't think anybody else is thinking that, but I was, being into the history. I was only there a few hours, and we were shelled for the first time, so that was scary. I actually had to run the whole length of the camp to find out where my flak jacket and helmet was, and all the old fellas are breaking their backsides laughing at me. So we never ran again, I tell you that, no matter what was happening, for fear of that happening. So that was interesting. And that night I got my accommodation, and we had an old kind of a billet, and my room in the billet seemed to be modern, and I was for weeks asking why my section of the billet looked a bit modern than the rest. And it turned out that about 4 years before that, my room had been knocked out with a tank shell, and he's fitted a new section into it. So that kind of worried me for a while. So that was good. But the Lebanon was dangerous, but it was exciting. I was young and I wasn't married and I had no children then. Different experience in Kosovo. It wasn't in so much danger, but it was more depressing. But Lebanon was a great experience. I got to see the Holy Land, Jerusalem. Got to see the Israeli army in motion, and the Irish army in motion. Had a great holiday. Felt like I did something good with my life for the 6 months, you know. Even though when I came back, when I came home, it was hard to settle back in for a while. My father told me the night I came home from Lebanon, I got very drunk. I'm sorry about that. But he put me to bed and I was trying to do karate on him. From the top of a bunk bed. That was a funny story from that, but it was a interesting experience, and I'm glad I did it.
Talk to me about the experience of warfare, because you know, when you train to be a soldier, when you're acting as a soldier, you know, it is obvious that, you know, that you would like to see some action somewhere along the way. I mean, was this something? Was this a different feeling, or was it what you expected when it happened?
I was never in combat, so I never got to watch. And I'm glad I never got to shoot anybody, although a couple of times in my career I felt like I could, especially when you see people mistreating other people. But when I came out of training, as every other soldier in the world will tell you, you're programmed, you're trained, you're the tool, all you basically are based is to a tool to fire a weapon, where you're told. So you come out of training and you're psyched up, you're ready to go to war basically, but there's no war. So you have to kind of come down off that high. And I was 4 years out of my recruit training before I went overseas. So I'd been around, I'd done a few other jobs. But when I got to Kosovo, to Lebanon, I wasn't going out there to be a soldier. I was going out there because everybody in the army wanted to go to Lebanon to do a bit of military experience. I didn't want to go to war. And when I was out there, I saw a lot about life. I learned a lot about life, that we're kind of we're wrapped in cotton wool in Ireland, basically. The world is not a nice place a lot of the times, you know. So when I was in Lebanon, I seen that dynamic, the mistreatment of people, the poverty. And sometimes out there, I could have picked up my rifle and said, I'm not letting that happen anymore. I could have shot somebody. I didn't do it. I'm glad I didn't do it. But you have that goes through your mind. It does go through your mind when you see people being mistreated by bullies, basically. And that wasn't always the Israelis or the DFF, which we did the militia. It was the Hezbollah, and it was the locals as well, you know. So I didn't come out and go out to Lebanon wanting to fight a war. My idea of going to Lebanon was the adventure. But when I got there, after a few weeks, I realised it's not so big an adventure when you see how life goes with other people, you know.
And then Kosovo, how did that compare with the Lebanon? What year did you go out to Kosovo?
I went to Kosovo, I think it was August 2000, and I came back the first week of April 2001, so it was 6 months in Kosovo. Kosovo, I got married in 1997, and I had a child later on that year, so he was 3 years old when I went to Kosovo, and it was a big decision to go. I think partly it was for the fuel bomb we would have received, and I still had a bit of adventure in me as well. I don't know how I still had that at that time, but and it was the big thing at the time. The Bosnian War was at its height, and Kosovo were having the troubles, and I thought I was going to do something good. Now, when I got to Kosovo, it's an Eastern Bloc country, very grey, very bleak. It was a winter trip. The Lebanon was a summer trip. I'd never seen weather like it in Kosovo. Plus, in Lebanon, we were being shelled. There was shootings every few weeks. Every few days, we'd have a shell warning or a groundhog, which means you had to go to cover because the area was going to be shelled. And that was pretty intense when that happened. But in Kosovo, there was none of that. No one in particular was trying to shell the Irish or shoot the Irish troops, although it happened once or twice where we had threats. A couple of explosions, a lot of murders, reprisals and stuff like that, you know. But it was more depressing. Nobody was trying to kill me. It wasn't so much danger, but it played more on my mind. I actually came out in Kosovo very, very depressed.
Why?
Without going too deep into it, I don't think things ran too well in the company I was with. But outside the loop of the company, I could see everything that was going on. I paid more attention to what was going on in the environment outside in the town. And this, you know, I paid more attention to what was going on in the dynamic of the people outside. I knew the history of the country. I knew the history of Ireland with the Republic and all that. And I was making comparisons all the time. But when I went out on the road, I could see the dynamic of everybody's life, what was going on. Because it was strange. Every church, every mosque nearly had to be guarded by the NATO troops that were out there. And the Irish company, which I was with, we were a transport company, basically. We were a theatre asset. We were on call to the force commander to do anything he wanted. So whereas other multinational brigades, the country was divided into four or five parts, and they were being taken out by multinational brigades. So you'd have the British on one end, the Americans one end, the Norwegians and the Swedes on another end. But we were a theatre wrestler, so we went through the whole country. We could go anywhere during the day. So we got to see everything, which was pretty unique, because most of the other contingents from other nations wouldn't have got to see the whole country like we did. And there was only 110 of us there at the time. And it was within 12 months of the end of the war. So there was still a lot of violence.
Yeah.
And we got to see everything. We were involved in the first free elections in the country. And the other thing we were involved in was the repatriation of remains from the mass graves. So we had to do that kind of stuff. Now, we weren't digging the graves, but we had to be there to take the bodies from the hole, put them on the truck, bring them to a morgue where they would be identified basically by the International Crimes Tribunal. And then after a while, they'd put the bodies back in containers, and we'd have to bring the containers to a drop-off point, which would be another mass grave where the families would take the remains of the people who were identified, and they'd have a big mass funeral. And that was very stressful, because you could sense the anger and the stress and the sadness, you know. But that kind of played a lot in my mind. The other thing was, I had a 3-year-old child, and it was his birthday when I was out there, and I missed him terrible, and he was sick on various occasions. But I kept making that comparison, that if anybody came into Ireland and tried to do that to my family, what would I do to them? So I was always making that comparison. And my uncle asked me one time, why do you want to go to Kosovo? And I said to him, I wouldn't like anybody to come to my door with a gun and try and kill my family. I'd like someone to try and help me. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's why I went out there. And I was kind of naive thinking that, because I came back awfully stressed out about it, you know. And I still have my moments from it, as a lot of other people do.
But it must have been very stressful indeed, you know, handling the bodies after they were shot and buried, and having to supervise what was going on.
Well, thank God we didn't have to handle the bodies. They were put into containers, and we just transported the containers on the escort and dropped them off. But it's saying that now, we had to go to a morgue once or twice, and the smell was unbelievable. But just knowing that they were in there and what you were handling was crazy, like, you know. Mm-hmm. It brought you right up to the point where that person died, even though we didn't see the remains. It brought you up to that point where you had to make this decision in your mind. How could you let that happen? How could these other factions do that? And what would you do if it was your family or your village? Like, you know. And plenty of times we had to go into villages where this had happened only a few weeks or a few months before. And you drive into the village and there'd be no men, hardly any young women, there'd be only very young children and very old people. And straight away you knew that this is a place where this happens, you know. And the children wouldn't come near you because we were wearing camouflage uniforms. And the last person they saw in a uniform was probably the person that did that. So you're always having to make friends and, how do they say it, win the hearts and minds, you know. Yeah. It's kind of a strange thing.
Yeah. You said there was trouble within the Irish Army there as well. You know, that what was going on in the Irish Army that you didn't like?
It's not that I didn't like it. I just felt that it was very stressful on me. I don't want to cause any snags for anybody, but I didn't feel at the time we were getting the proper support sometimes, you know. There was a thing going on as well at the time. The depleted uranium was going on. You probably remember that, the depleted uranium from the Iraq war in the early 90s. Well, there was a lot of soldiers still suffering from that. But when we were in Kosovo, we used to have a television in the billet. And when you came off your patrol, you came in at night, you'd watch television. We used to watch Coronation Street and EastEnders and Brookside, you know, because that was all you had, basically. And actually, if you were late going to your dinner, it was probably because you were watching Brookside. So we'd have a thing where here's the Brookside crowd in, or here's the EastEnders crowd in. And these are all men, which is kind of funny because you wouldn't watch it at home. But in the interval, you'd see British broadcasters, Germany. It's the British Forces broadcast and media, and it's broadcast from Germany, but it was for British soldiers' families, basically. But we used to get that because the British were in the multinational brigade up the road, about 10 miles away. So we could get that on the TV. And they were showing these soldiers who had been in Iraq, but some of them had been in Kosovo in the 12-month period before us, and they were very sick. And there were stories of 18 and 21-year-old soldiers in the dozens who were dying or from depleted uranium, even Italian guys. So it came up that they had used depleted uranium weapons in Kosovo. And we were told that we would not be going to these places. And they actually told us in the media at home that there was going to be no Irish soldier in an area where depleted uranium was used. But we were a theater as I said, and we did get to see all these places. So that came up. We felt like we weren't being told everything. But I'm not sure where we were or not. It's not important now. But the families at home were pretty stressed out about that, you know, because they were seeing it on the RTE news here, and we weren't hearing that end of it, you know. So there was a lot of trouble over that. But
did you feel that it might worry you or worry your...
Oh, I was worried when I came home because... we were very worried about it, yeah. Depleted uranium, it's a radiation that stays in the ground for thousands of years, and there's been a lot of trouble over it. And the Americans are still having, British are still having trouble over it from the first Iraq war, which is 1990. Soldiers are still dying from that, you know, and it's a very dangerous weapon, and it was used in Kosovo. We've seen the damage of it, you know. But when I came home from Kosovo, my wife got pregnant, and I don't like saying this, but I was worried sick when the baby was coming, even going for the scan in case of something wrong, you know. So
what has that done to you, you know, all those years, all that experience, 18 years is it?
18 so far, years, yeah.
Well, now you've 3 years to go in the army still, but at this point, with that experience behind you, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about a soldier in the army?
How do I feel about a soldier in the army? I think with society the way it is now in Ireland, it's a good thing for young men and young women to go into the army, even for the 3 to 5 year experience, because it disciplines them and it trains them for life. And I do a lot of teaching of history in the army, and when I have recruit courses in, which would be new inductees, I say this to them. I said, now, if you do 2 weeks in the army or 2 years in the army, it's good basis for life. But the army can make you cynical about a lot of things as well. And I know sometimes I feel very cynical about it. Now, I have a younger brother who worked in various jobs before he joined the army. I know he actually talked him into joining. And he's in there 5 years. And since he joined the army, he's settled down. He has a girlfriend. He's 2 children. So he's starting to make a life for him, you know. And I see people younger than him and people his age walking around doing nothing, you know. And the other thing is, you get a life experience. They go overseas and they see what's going on in the world, you know. And some of them can't figure it out, but it's good to see that, because it makes you go outside that comfort loop where you are in Ireland. I'm okay, nothing can bother me. But once you see a bit of life, you realise that you can't be bothered and you have to make the best, you know. So is that what you mean?
Yeah. Does it get your priorities in place? In other words, you spoke about your family so important, and you know.
Well, it'd be different for different people. Young lads coming in, they won't be getting married straight away. I didn't get married till I was 7 years in the army. So then, once that's where my priority started, I had to look after my family. The young lads are still going for the adventure. Some of them will have children and families, but that's what you mean, I think.
Yeah, because when I think when young people join the army, that it gives them a grounding and it sets them up for life. But Do you think it just should be a transition, you know, that you go into the army, you get a couple of years and then you move on?
Well, I think that would be a good thing. It would be a good thing, but I don't think that'll ever happen. We can't really have conscription in this country unless they change the constitution, basically.
Hi, okay.
I'm saying you can't really have a system like that unless you bring conscription in or change the constitution where people, you need a bigger army, basically, because you can't just come in for 3 years without having a bigger army, because you'll have everybody trying to do it. But it is a good basis and a good grounding for life.
Would it be a good idea to, for young lads, as soon as they finish with schooling, that to go into the army for a while and then to continue in the rest of their lives, that it would be a good grounding for them, a kind of conscription in a way?
Well, conscription won't work in Ireland unless the constitution has changed, and I don't think it'll work because you've a small army. And a lot of things would have to change in society for that to happen. But I do think, as you said, that it's a good idea for young lads to come into the army after school for a period, a short period. But the thing about that, other things have to change as well, because if you come in at 17, 18, 19 years after school and you leave after 3 or 4 years, you're in your early 20s, unless you get a trade or a skill that you can use outside from the army, you're just going back out to nothing, you see. So you need a kind of a something to sell to an employer, if you know what I mean. But the good thing about the army is you learn to earn, look after yourself, you don't hang on to your mammy strings anymore, like that kind of stuff, you know. You can stand up and defend yourself, you can talk about yourself, you know what I mean? You get more articulate and stuff like that, and you're not twiddling your thumbs anymore. You can stand up with your back straight and go and present yourself and do a lot of things like you didn't think you could. Confidence, basically, you know. Now, confidence is only gets you so far. You can't go into an employer and say, well, I can jump off a helicopter under fire and run out to a tree and take out the enemy at 50 paces kind of thing. You can't tell that to an employer, not unless you're going to be a mercenary or something. But you need a skill, and unless the army gives you a skill, not many people, not everybody in the army gets a trade, like, you know. Yeah. That's what I'm saying to you. So it's good in one way and it's bad in the other way.
What about the fitness aspect of the army?
Well, the army's gone mad into the fitness now, more so because of the European battle groups, I suppose, and overseas peacekeeping missions and all that. Everybody, it's a big thing now for going for promotion. You have to pass the fitness test every year, and it can come down to who got the fastest time on a run, or whoever punched out the highest amount of press-ups. A position can go to the person who has the most. It depends, but it has happened. And that's a good thing, because it means the army is a lean, mean fight machine. That's what they want, everybody to be soldiers. Whereas a few years ago, you can remember all the media stuff going on about overweight soldiers. It's very, very hard to find an overweight soldier in the army these days. Very, very hard. And if you do, he's probably sick.
And Michael, finally, can I ask you about your own work as a historian, an army historian in the Irish Army? And what exactly are you doing?
I'm the curator of the Air Corps Military Museum and Heritage Project, which I kind of created and set up myself about 5 years ago. How that came about, when I came home from Kosovo, as I told you, I wasn't feeling the healthiest, and my wife, no one was into history, said, why don't you do a course on history? And I went to Maynooth, did 4 years of a local history degree, and then I did a master's degree. So I've used that skill, which I paid for myself and which I studied in the evening time, to set the museum up. And I go around teaching everybody from recruits, inductees, up to officers about Irish military and political history and European history. Because it's not really taught in school anymore. History is an option. It's not, how would you say, it's not
that important. Well, it doesn't seem to be.
It's not on the agenda anymore. Yeah. Yeah, it's an option for students, which means that most of the younger generation don't know an awful lot, or if anything, about Irish history. So if you're a soldier, basically, my idea is if you're a soldier, they're going out to defend the integrity of the state in the air, on land, and at sea, and the integrity of the state, the sovereign of the country of Ireland, the Republic, is the people. So you're a sovereign citizen of Ireland in a uniform defending the sovereign people of Ireland, which is what it's all about. But you must know what you're there for. What's the history of the army? It's tradition, it's the spirit of the corps, and it means that you know exactly what the army stands for, you know. So that's the message I'm trying to get through to people. And people have been risking their lives to do that since 1922, since we had independence. But the Irish people don't know too much about the Irish Defence Forces, other than up until recently that they went out and they done the bins, or they looked after the lifts in Ballymun, or when there's a bus strike, they drive the buses, you know. But it's a lot more than that. It's a lifestyle. And 100 soldiers have died wearing the Irish uniform overseas. Ask any civilian, anybody in the country who's not in the army. Ask most soldiers, they couldn't answer that question, how many have died. But there are 100 soldiers that left their families, went overseas with the idea that they're going to come back with a few bob in their pocket and do something with their family, but they didn't come back, you see. So that's a legacy that the Irish Defence Forces have that is not being portrayed properly. I'm not saying they're not doing it properly because they're not doing it. It's just that it's not understood. And that's the message I'm trying to get out to people, that we have a history and this is what it means to be a soldier. It's going to change your life and it's changed other people's lives, and this is what it's all about. You're wearing the emblem, the uniform of the Irish people.
Yeah. Well, Michael Whelan, thank you for telling me your story.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.